503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.
De nuevo, esta música de baile.
There was heaven and there was earth.
Después de esta pieza, vamos a escuchar una comunicación simpática y cruel con alguien.
That's Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You're tuned in to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcasting live from the KBOO studios here in Portland, Oregon. I'm Tori Bortman, here joined today with my co-host, April Streeter. Good morning, April.
Good morning, Tori.
Today, we're going to jump into one of the hottest button issues in cycling, one that many of our listeners may not even know is an issue, electric-assisted mountain bikes. We'll be joined by Adam Craig, Olympian, former pro cyclist, and current Giant Bicycles rep, as well as Oregon Timber Trail board member and trail steward. And later in the hour, we'll also have Michelle Healy of Bend Parks and Recreation to talk with us a bit about how the city of Bend, Oregon, decided to allow electric mountain bikes on their city park trails. But first, April's here to bring us some of the latest headlines from this week, December 5th, 2018. April?
Thanks, Tori. Just a couple of news items today. The BBC reports that Bologna, Italy city planner Marco Amadori has come up with a novel way to get more of his city's residents and visitors to ride bikes, rewarding them with free ice cream, gelato, beer, and cinema tickets. Using an app and recording rides, walks, and use of public transportation earns the incentives. The system of point collection is based not on the distance you travel, but on a single trip, because it's important that even for short trips of 1 kilometer, you do it in a sustainable way, Amadori explained. So far, over 100 local businesses have signed up to give away vouchers. 16,000 of those were claimed last year, with more than 3.7 million kilometers of travel recorded. And next up, actor William Shatner, best known for his role as Captain Kirk in the TV series Star Trek, still going strong at age 87, acting, releasing a memoir, and recording a country music album. He credits much of his stamina to a daily regimen of exercise with a key component, which is cycling. "I always made fitness activities a part of my everyday life," he says in an LA Times interview. "In the last 2 years, I've done something new that has added immensely to my fitness and quality of life. Bike. An electric bike. It's magic," he says. He has had bicycles throughout his life, but the new ones he and his wife, Anne, bought have resulted in 20 to 30 mile rides. "I live in the hills of the San Fernando Valley," he says, "so going up a hill on a bike is meaningful and emotional, giving you a good day or a bad day. Well, with electric assist, every day is a good day. I'm pedaling my ass off, man. When the bike ride's over, I feel perfect." Shatner recommends getting a three-wheeler electric bicycle for elderly people with balance issues. An electric trike gets you out. Suddenly you're seeing neighbors, riding to the grocery store, and giving the bird to cars, he concludes. That's all for this month's KBOO Bike Show news headlines. Back to you, Tori.
April, thank you so much for that update. And before we get to today's guest, it's really important to understand a bit of background about electric assist bicycles and electric assist mountain bikes in particular. So first, electric bikes, commonly referred to as e-bikes, hit the U.S. market a little over a decade ago. The first wave of e-bikes were utilitarian, mostly made for riding and commuting in cities. They were marketed as a way for people to be able to use their bikes further and faster, and there were two main types. One that has a throttle like a motorcycle that gives the bike power from an electric motor, and the other known as pedal assist, which also has an electric motor, but can kind of keep track of how much torque the rider is giving to the pedals. And when the amount of effort from the rider is too high, the motor helps the pedals turn, therefore assisting the pedals and, of course, the rider. April, you yourself own a few e-bikes. Can you tell us a bit about what you have and how you use them?
Yeah, sure. So I got my first e-bike back in 2013, thinking that the e-bike revolution was right around the corner. And I was wrong about that. But I bought a Sanyo pedal assist bike with two levels of assist. And what I found for me, being a city cyclist, was that electric assist and pedal assist really furthered my ride, similar in a way to how Shatner describes it. Before that, I thought that 5 miles of city riding was definitely a ride. And after I got pedal assist, an 8 mile round trip or a 10 mile round trip was no longer so daunting, especially when considering the hills. So for me, that first e-bike broadened my horizon of what a city bike ride could be, what a commute could be, and still be comfortable and happy. And then a little later after that, I bought an electric assist similar bike for my son to commute to school because he was prone to starting late. And so with the electric assist, he got to school on time. And then my third e-bike was an electric cargo bike, which was not pedal assist, but was a throttle. It is a throttle system. And I use that to take my my stuff along with me. I use it for giving e-delivered yoga lessons. I take all my yoga gear in there, including the mats, and it's got a cargo in the front. And that way I can get a longer distance to see my clients or to give yoga classes and have all my gear with me.
So what would you consider a longer distance to be?
Well, in a city ride, I'd still say that a 8 to 10 miles would be a longer distance, that it's really helpful to have that assist.
Yeah, especially if you're going to go teach something physical, like a yoga lesson when you get there.
Exactly.
Excellent. So as the bikes became more ubiquitous and accepted in the U.S., the market has already exploded in Europe and especially Asia. With this huge jump in the market, electric assist road-style bikes and electric assist mountain bikes became part of the picture as well. Currently in Europe and Asia, the largest growing segment of any part of cycling is e-bikes, mostly because they make cycling more accessible for everyone. Particularly, I would say, those who are older or trying to get further distances more done, or maybe who have health issues, is what I've mostly seen. In the U.S., this is also the case, at least for e-bikes that are allowed on roads or paved trails. In fact, the cost of e-bikes has dropped by thousands of dollars over the past 5 years, making them more available to the average consumer. To explain why e-mountain bikes are different, we need to go into a bit of history. I'd like to quote a 2016 article by Gunnar Waldman from Teton Gravity about why mountain bikes in the United States are considered so differently than they are in Europe or Asia, and it has a lot to do with our public lands. So how federal wilderness came to be? In 1984, the Wilderness Act, following pressure from naturalists and wilderness advocacy groups, the Wilderness Act of 1964 designated certain U.S. areas as strictly prohibited from commercial interests. That's a good thing. We don't want federal land used for predatory, toxic waste dumping, fracking, clear cutting, strip mining, et cetera. Specifically, this act did three things. Number one, it created a way for Congress and Americans to designate wilderness areas. That designation would represent our nation's most stringent form of land protection. The areas include any land under jurisdiction of the U.S. government, including national forest, National Parks, National Wildlife Refuges, Bureau of Land Management, or BLM lands. No roads, motorized vehicles, commercial activity like logging or mining, or permanent structures were allowed in these designated wilderness areas.
Makes sense.
Number two, it created the National Wilderness Preservation System to manage these protected wilderness area. This system leverages the USDA Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the National Park Service, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services. And number three, it immediately put 9.1 million acres of wild American lands into this national preservation system for protection. Today, at least this was in 2016, because this is now currently, even as of today, changing. The amount of land has grown to roughly 109 million acres with 762 individual wilderness areas. Now, currently, this is an aside from the article, some of those have been and are continuing to be taken away by the Trump administration. The act also succinctly and beautifully defines wilderness as a wilderness in contrast with those areas where man and his own works dominate the landscape is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. We need space where ecosystems remain intact, evolve organically, where wildlife can go unmolested, and a place where people can reconnect with nature at peace. So we can leave it alone. And in 20 years, we were all able to bike, hike, and for 20 years, everyone was able to bike, hike, and ride horses and enjoy these together. Then in 1984, mountain bikes got the boot. In 1984, the Wilderness Act was reinterpreted by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Forest Service because of pressure from the Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society to specifically ban bicycles from wilderness areas. They don't or didn't like mountain bikes. The relevant provision interpreted in the act is Selection 4, which prohibits, quote, the use of motor vehicles, motorized equipment, or motorboats, no landing of aircraft, no other form of mechanical transport. The initial USDA interpretation of that section was mechanical transport herein as used shall include any contrivance which travels over the ground, snow, or water on wheels, tracks, skids, or by flotation is propelled by a non-living power source contained or carried on or within the device. Of course, this explicitly defined, restricted, motorized, and or mechanicalized travel as any conveyance propelled by a non-living power source. Specifically, that means motors. The original regulation language probably came from a discussion in 1964 about what mechanical transport actually means, and a bicycle certainly is a machine which does provide mechanical advantage to propel us faster than we can go on two legs. Though Congress was most certainly not thinking about regulating bikes in 1964, and obviously neither was the Forest Service, the four agencies responsible for implementing the act had broad discretion to each define terms on their own. Though why four separate agencies enforced the act and why they were given broad discretion to interpret it is anyone's guess. Regardless, in 1984, the USDA Forest Service reinterpreted mechanical with language amending the definition to include or is a bicycle or hang glider. Yes, that simple bit was added in 1984 for designated wilderness areas. In their defense, there was not a lot of data that showed mountain biking's impact one way or another, and the USDA was under pressure to do something. Unfortunately, one domino tips another. The other three land agencies that manage wilderness, the Bureau of Land Management, the National Park Service, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, soon also interpreted mechanical to mean bicycle. Maddeningly, all current research shows mountain biking does not have a greater impact on trails and nature than any other activity allowed by the Wilderness Act. But government isn't great at changing policy, and even in the face of overwhelming research, there's support for an entrenched position. To be clear, not all national forests carry the wilderness designation. There is single-track riding on some national forests that don't carry that protection. However, the balance between management and riders can be different in those areas too, and the government position is often used as guidance. Go ahead.
Oh, I just was, okay, so to be clear, since 1984, if the forest is designated a wilderness area, mountain bikes are specifically prohibited.
Correct.
Okay.
Period.
Yeah.
End stop.
Okay.
So where we're at today, going back to the article by Gunther, the mountain bikers are now forced to oppose using wilderness designation to protect beautiful spaces, even though we ride, dig trails, and advocate for nature because we enjoy being out in it. We don't like strip mining. We find peace, excitement, and invigoration in nature just like everyone else.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So, of course, wilderness designation is only relative to federal land, but that doesn't mean you can just ride any place that's not federally managed. The rest of our riding land is either state or privately owned. Someone always manages the land, and unless that's you, they get to decide if mountain bikers can use it or not. Inspiration for many current rules came from federal guidelines and the fight is the same. States' parks generally are amenable to mountain biking unless a particular onerous relationship exists between them. Often, control of state land is ceded to friends of organization. Local governments can go either way. Sometimes they view trails and riders as tourism and economic boon, or they can think of us as troublemakers. Rural populations have occasionally spoken out against the federal wilderness designation, keeping lands local because their economic reliance on bicycle tourism or natural resources, or may protest against other restrictions wilderness brings to public lands. So all of that being said, that's kind of the end of the quote of the article. All of that being said, we find ourselves in a situation now where mountain bike use in any federal land is always extremely contentious.
Yes.
So, and what we've found in the last 10 or 15 years is that mountain bike use has gotten less and less, it has gotten more and more restricted in those same areas.
Mm.
So now we get to the point where with much of our society today, technology has not kept up with the law.
Mm.
And welcome to e-mountain bikes. If anyone, by the way, is interested in that full article, we will post it on our Facebook page after the show. So now we add in this advent of electric mountain bikes, which are most definitely motorized.
Right.
But motorized at a point, first of all, they're electric, so they're quieter, and motorized to a point in the United States, interestingly, up to 20 miles an hour, but in Europe, only up to 10 miles an hour. And what most mountain bikers who have ridden them say is 20 miles an hour is far too fast for what anyone generally wants to go on a soft surface trail. If you are on a road, yes, but otherwise you can't control the bike in the terrain at that speed. When you add in electric bikes, the future for electric mountain bikes looks pretty bleak for trail use. So why are we devoting a whole show to it? Because e-mountain bikes are here. They're already being used on our public lands, whether it's technically allowed or not. And the cycling industry is seeing e-bikes as their largest growth potential. We here at the KBU Bike Show thought it was time to take a closer look at the current state and science behind trail use and what e-bikes might mean for that. You are listening to the KBU Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBU studios in Portland, Oregon. I'd like to bring in our first guest, Adam Craig, Adam Craig apparently is not with us yet, so we are going to introduce our first guest, Michelle Healy, the Planning and Park Service Director for the Bend, Oregon Parks and Recreation District. Michelle Healy, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Michelle, unlike a lot of places, the Bend Parks and Recreation District has decided to allow e-bikes on their trails. So my first question for you is actually, have you ever ridden an e-mountain bike or any e-bike before, or are you even a mountain biker yourself?
Well, I have not ridden an e-bike. A number of the staff people here that helped us with our rulemaking either ride e-bikes or have ridden them, have talked with industry representatives and other user groups. So, you know, I would rely on them for their expertise and experience to inform on that. I am a casual mountain biker. You're not going to see me on a bunch of technical single tracks, but you'll see me out there on, double track or, you know, some of the Forest Service roads and other things.
I love that you call yourself a casual mountain biker. That's such a great kind of designation. Why do you choose, would you choose in a day to casually mountain bike over casually go for a road bike ride or ride around the city?
Well, you know, I do all of those things, too. I'm a bike commuter, particularly in the summertime. Here in Bend, it's a little easier than in the winter. But, you know, it's just to mix up the recreational experience. I have kids and others that I'd like to go out with, and so that's what would, you know, cause me to want to go out and go for a mountain bike ride. But I'm definitely probably more inclined to go on a hike than I am a mountain bike ride, just because I don't have to pack up a bike and go do it. So
yeah, that's absolutely. I was just curious because you seem like, yeah, this isn't your primary. So I'm always curious to know what draws people in. It sounds like for you, it's a little bit of like community or socialization of the people that you're riding with.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, doing something different and, you know, just getting outside, whatever that is, and whatever the time frame I have to do it is probably going to be what influences me ultimately. So.
Absolutely. Well, and being, it sounds like you're a parent, that definitely yes. time frame is limited. So
Right.
Bend Parks and Recreation made a bold move by allowing electric mountain bikes in their parks with soft surface trails. What was the process like to come to that decision?
Well, you know, Bend Park and Rec is pretty different than, you know, the federal system and the state parks in that we offer an urban trail system. And so we have a mix of soft surface in some areas, and then we have, you know, with native dirt trails, and then we have kind of that soft surface gravel, and then we have hard surface.
And what would you consider a native dirt trail?
Like a single track, not, you know, it's been manipulated by our trails crew and built, but it's not necessarily that we've brought in outside materials to any extent. You know, I mean, maybe a little bit here and armoring things and doing some other things, but not a...
you haven't like paved it or graveled the entire trail or something like that.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we've made improvements to it, but it's... not the big equipment that you're going to see and that kind of stuff that you'll see probably more in this towards the urban center. And then we have a lot of trails also that are on detrider roads for canals, so the access roads that the canal districts use, and those are all either gravel or sort of a compacted dirt surface, and so that's part of our trail system as well.
Interesting.
And our here in Bend, for us, so much of what we heard from our community in the last few years in terms of the planning we've done is how important trails are, not only for recreation, but also for people to get around and be connected. And so we see e-bikes as a way to help people do that. And we didn't want to be creating our rules in such a way that would preclude that opportunity. There are some trails that we have in areas that we'll keep an eye on if we see that they're being damaged or if we're going to start hearing a lot about conflicts. But so far we haven't. You know, and the hardcore mountain bikers aren't necessarily coming to our trails to for that experience. They're going to the forest. They're going to BLM, maybe state parks or some other private land. So we're a little bit different than the other providers out there in terms of what we manage.
Well, and you're a little bit different in that, you know, Portland as an urban area, we really have very few soft surface native trails like how you describe them. We maybe have a few on Powell Butte, some in Forest Park, but we don't really have that many that are, and none of the, well, few of those, a few on Powell Butte, but otherwise, few of those are not open to mountain biking at all. Whereas in Bend, even before you allowed e-mountain bikes on them, they were already allowed on those trails, correct?
Right. We have one location where bikes, any kind of bike is not permitted, and dogs aren't permitted either. It's called Riley Ranch Nature Reserve, and that's just one location. But everywhere else, bikes are permitted, dogs are permitted on leash, and e-bikes are permitted on the trails within limitations. We do the Class 1 e-bikes, you know, which for us, we don't see very many e-bikes on our trails anyway. But, you know, you can be out there, and so far, since we've changed our rules on it, we have not seen any. Some of the fears have really not come to fruition, at least that we've seen yet.
Michelle, this is April. I was wondering, could you explain from the perspective of Bend Parks what a Class 1 e-bike is so that our listeners understand that?
Sure. It's the 1,000-watt e-bike pedal assist, so it's not going to have, you know, the pure throttle that you can just go and crank it up. It's 20-mile-an-hour speed. It's you need to be pedaling to be using it. And it's the ones we see most frequently with our tourist businesses in town. They're kind of that first stage of the e-bike out there. You know, one concern was the weight and the speed.
Yes.
And so that's where we kind of settled on, you know, this class one designation for the type of bike. Now, I'm going to be straightforward. When we're out enforcing it, if we see somebody on a different kind of e-bike, one, we may not know that it's a different kind of e-bike necessarily. And if they're not traveling, you know, at some higher rate of speed, if they're even able to do that, the likelihood is if they're complying with generally the park rules and being respectful of other users, it's probably not going to be, we don't have bike police out there.
Yeah. Right, absolutely.
People around and asking for their, you know, certification on their bike.
Their paperwork.
Their paperwork, right.
I have another question. So it just, it sounds like that the process wasn't particularly contentious to come to this set of rules, and it hasn't been as contentious as you thought it might be since you put the rules in place. But it does feel like technology, as Troy was saying, the technology is ahead of us, and so that's going to, I would think, eventually bring more of the other type of e-mountain bikers to your trails. And so I guess my question is, do you feel internally prepared for that, or if you see it in a different way, if you could describe how you see the future?
Well, you know, I think it's like a lot of technology that happens, right? It comes out and kind of goes, and then we all try to respond to it, and then we can, you know, say, hey, no, we can't do this, we can't do that. So I don't feel comfortable saying we're 100% prepared for it, but I feel like we are watching it. We're talking within our design team about what kind of changes, you know, ultimately would we need to be making to try to accommodate e-bikes. I mean, we see them as offering access to recreation to the broadest portion of the population. You can get people out there that otherwise couldn't be out biking. You know, I could go riding bikes with my 70-year-old dad that maybe we wouldn't be able to do that together if he wasn't able to use something like that if he wanted to. So I think, you know, we're going to have to keep watching it. Our system, like I said, we're not the destination for the, you know, for most mountain bikers, ultimately.
Right, absolutely.
And so we do provide links, though, to federal land and state land. And so for us moving forward, I think what's going to be key is understanding what those land managers are dealing with and thinking about, because we certainly don't want it where somebody takes off from one of our spots thinking they can go out and then they hit that line and suddenly they can't. That's not a good experience for anybody. So not to say we would change our rule, but I think we'd want to be able to change our communication and information for people and other things so that they have a good experience. So
I'm going to bring you back to something you said a couple minutes ago about that thus far, and I'm curious when the rule came into place and how long it's been, but you said thus far you haven't seen the conflicts that people were worried about. Was there a lot of pushback? Has there been a lot of pushback since it's been instated? And what has that looked like? You said you haven't seen very many conflicts. Have you seen any, have you noticed any yourself personally?
You know, so we updated our park rules this last summer, during the summer, and one of the things we addressed was the e-bikes, and that trying to make that decision, like, you know, whether or not we were going to allow them on our trails. We had some public outreach. We received one comment of concern that they would travel too fast and that they would be heavy if there was a, you know, a collision of some sort or somebody had an accident. But other than that, we, you know, didn't really hear much, even internally working with our natural resources and trail staff and stewardship staff, which is kind of like our rangers, and even the law enforcement, we really didn't get a whole lot of
pushback.
We got questions. But like I said, our mission is kind of evolving to support, you know, active transportation. And so
any kind of electric bike fits really well.
And we just did 2 years of outreach in the community, and more generally, trails and having that opportunity for commuting and getting to different places was so high that for us it just seemed like, I think I said before, just counter to our goals of supporting that, to say e-bikes wouldn't be allowed. And we made that choice kind of with that transportation mind,
right,
or thoughts in mind. And then we haven't had really any significant complaints or really complaints at all about e-bikes. Even the trails crew that really works on all these things, I've asked them, I've said, have you seen? And they said they really haven't. They haven't seen damage. They haven't seen, conflicts happening. I mean, we have conflicts with other uses going on for sure, where people are trying to mountain bike and do other things. But between the e-bikes and the regular bikes or other users, it just hasn't risen high. We've heard about concerns out in the National Forest for sure, since we link to that. I would point out too, as a local government agency, mm-hmm. the way we are set up is we have, we're a little bit more nimble in terms of our ability to make changes and to, you know, either respond reactively or proactively if we see something going on. So our rules allow us to make changes in a much easier way.
Your entrenchment of the bureaucracy is a little bit more shallow than other organizations. Yeah.
Yeah, and so that also gave us some confidence that if we did really see a problem start on, say, a section of trail somewhere, we have the ability to make a rule change that would just affect that area without going through a big process that some of our other, larger government organizations would have to go through. So that gave us a little security to say, hey, we're going to do this. We think it's a positive thing ultimately. We think we want to figure out how we can all coexist and meet these competing needs. And yeah, we might have to tweak it in the future. And like you pointed out, technology maybe change. It will change. Not maybe. It will change, and we're going to have to adapt to that. But we didn't want to come down kind of hard line on this.
That's such a heartening and excellent place to start. You are listening to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBOO studios in Portland, Oregon, on 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM on the web. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us for the second half of our show when we continue our conversation about electric mountain bikes. Welcome back to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcasting from the KBOO studios in Portland, Oregon. We're continuing our conversation about electric assist bicycle, mountain bicycles, and we're here with our guest, Michelle Healy, Planning and Park Services Director for the Bend, Oregon Parks and Recreation District. And also joining us is Adam Craig, Olympian, former pro cyclist, current Giant Bicycles rep, Oregon Timber Trail board member, and trail steward, who is joining us today by phone from the backwoods of Bend, Oregon. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Oh. How you guys doing? Thanks for having me.
Great. How are you out there in the cold woods?
We found a little shelter. It's pretty breezy, but we've got a pretty good little work site set up here. So we're doing just fine.
And what are you doing out in the woods today?
We're just doing a little bit of trail maintenance and a little bit of riding, just taking advantage of the long fall. We can kind of get ahead of all of our all of our things we normally have to do in the spring. So
excellent. So you're actually literally doing trail stewardship while you're on the phone with us. So that's,
well, I mean, I'm taking a lunch break right now, but well, yeah, thanks for the yeah, lunch break.
But you are out there kind of stewarding the trails, which is excellent. So you are an e-mountain bike owner, which might be some surprising to some because you're known as an excellent pro racer, and you seem like the least likely person to either want or need one. So why do you own one?
I mean, because it's the 21st century and we own a lot of different things, ultimately. but I largely have an e-mountain bike, a full suspension bike that's a, you know, class one e-bike, pedal assist, that I mostly use for doing trail stewardship, just for getting a big heavy chainsaw or whatever tools and material we need into these backcountry work sites. We're starting to do a lot more backcountry trail stewardship, and helping maintain these networks that haven't seen much maintenance because they're really challenging to access. So I'm basically using the e-bike as an access tool.
And when you say, when you say challenging, do you mean challenging by terrain or distance or both?
Both, up in the mountains. I mean, you know, you're all the equipment you need for, you know, to be clearing trail, the chainsaw weighs 30 pounds or something by the time you bring your fuel and your saw and everything you need, all your safety equipment. So getting that stuff up there, or just hand tools for doing drainage work. A lot of these backcountry trails haven't had drainage work in decades and really need it as they're starting to see more use. So we're just, yeah, using it to get whatever heavy things into the woods up. I might do a 3,000 or 4,000 foot climb, you know, that would take 3 hours with tools and it takes me 45 minutes. So I get to where I'm working and I'm ready to get to work instead of exhausted.
So yeah, there's kind of a theory out there, and April, you can speak to this a little bit too, that e-bikes are seen as cheating somehow. But obviously that's
I mean,
that's not cheating.
Yes, I mean, if we're cheating to catch up on a decades-long maintenance backlog on our public lands, then I guess we're cheating. But I don't know, I feel like people are pretty excited that we're getting some work done. And as far as, you know, that's a conversation, right? And that's really just social stuff. That's kind of people and their perceptions of what the world currently is and their fear of what the world might change into. But the reality is the world changes, you know, and we fly around on airplanes. Like, you can say getting to Europe on a 747 is cheating. You should probably swim, and you probably should swim.
Oh, I have a question about that, Adam. So before you got an e-mountain bike, did you have a different perception of e-bikes in general?
I didn't, because I'm pretty open-minded, but I certainly understand why people have a different perception of e-bikes, and I think those perceptions can be well-founded in times, and if they're also surrounded with constructive conversation, they can be good, or good to consider. But ultimately, it's—I don't know—there's a lot of technology in the 21st century, and humans are using all of it for a variety of things. You know, it's kind of my baseline viewpoint on it, but that's just me personally. So,
well, and
we're kind of talking about the collective.
E-mountain biking is all over Europe, and you definitely spent a good portion of your career racing in Europe. Why is it thriving there as opposed to here? And I've heard that really the European market, those manufacturers were the kind of the first ones to come in with e-mountain bikes, and now almost as if bike manufacturers like Trek or Giant or Specialized weren't being taken seriously in the European market because they didn't have e-mountain bikes. What's kind of the difference? Why is it thriving there?
I'm not entirely sure. I was actually just in Europe for a Giant media event for a pedal bike a few months ago, and we also had some e-bikes there that we were using for a variety of things, and I was just riding them and kind of looking at the landscape of where access was. And I think the reality is just Europeans have a pretty different approach to shared public space, and the general social structure is, I think, a little bit less contentious and a little bit more open-minded. There's a lot more of a kind of live and let live attitude over there, where if you're not doing any harm, which people riding e-bikes aren't, then have at it. And to be honest, the user density of most of the trail infrastructure in the Alps sees so many more users than most of the places that we're bickering about e-bike use here in America. There are so many people in the European Alps, and everyone's very tolerant. Families hike in, you're cruising by them on an e-bike, you say hello, they say hello, and it's fine. So basically, mountain biking was never really necessarily legalized in Europe. It just kind of was a use that started and seemed to be happening in conjunction
organically with the other uses, and that was fine for everyone, and their e-bikes are the same. Some people are just letting it be that at a basic social level, and there's a bunch of local policy decisions that have been made in a lot of places to support all of that, but it's just that the culture is genuinely different in my estimation.
So the use that we're seeing increasing in the United States that everyone's a little bit in up in arms or fretting about, that there's so many more people on this in this world, people really are valuing having that nature experience. There's something in the culture that maybe that's already been going on for so long, and that the number of because the population is so dense in Europe, that's kind of just already, it's an issue that maybe was never even an issue because the density was already so much higher. The public land was less, and everybody kind of understood from point one that we have to share.
Yeah, and there certainly are places in Europe that people aren't riding e-bikes, and those are the places that you shouldn't be riding e-bikes. And that's great. That's just, you know, they've been able to manage it more organically, and that's ultimately where it's going to be in North America at some point. It's just a matter of us getting there. And that being, you know, a lot of different conversations with a lot of different stakeholders, but ultimately I think just people being a little bit more open-minded. So I hope we can get there, and if we can't, then we can't, and maybe it isn't congruent with the nuances of our land access here, you know. But I think there's places to fit it in, and I think there's more places to not fit it in here, maybe, because we do have these lesser traveled recreation opportunities, like the, you know, semi-primitive non-motorized end of the recreation opportunity spectrum provides access for mountain bikes right now, and probably isn't congruent with e-bikes or just more density of any type. You know, it's more about density than the particular type of use, in my opinion. So it's just a matter of, you know, zooming out and looking at where it makes sense.
So we also have Michelle Healy from Bend Park and Recreation, and she is been talking about the access of e-mountain bikes on the Bend Parks and Recs controlled trails, or at least some of them. Have you ridden an e-bike on those trails, or have you seen? I know you probably ride some of those trails, if nothing else, to on a pedal bike to access more pedal biking beyond. Have you had experience with either riding an e-bike on those trails or seeing people riding e-bikes on trails, and what has that experience been like?
I haven't seen many people riding e-bikes on the Bend Parks and Rec trails. I really appreciate Michelle's presence here today, and I was listening to some of her comments earlier, so thanks for all of that, Michelle, and ultimately for BPRD doing a great job being kind of a local level governmental organization that has the opportunity to be more connected with the people that are using your resource, and acknowledging that the way you guys are managing e-bike access to the Parks and Rec trails with a focus on just practical transportation, people getting around town, is awesome. And I think it's the first step in kind of building, you know, from the local to the state to the federal level, to really start to affect some change with e-bikes, and also just get some examples of what's actually happening. And I don't really see many e-bikes on, you know, I use the river trail to get around quite a bit. And to be honest, I live in a part of town that it's not that hilly, so I just ride my pedal bike around mostly, just because I'm kind of used to doing it, and I don't really bother riding my big cool suspension e-bike around town. I have a bit and have used Parks and Rec trails, and I've really enjoyed the way to get around town. And to be honest, I'm kind of going the same speed on my commuter bike on those trails as I am on the e-bike. You know, they're flat. I'm going sort of fast if I'm in a rush, so it feels the same to me. I've seen a good solid handful of people out. Everyone seems pretty cool, but I really haven't seen many. I mean, how much are you seeing, Michelle?
You know, I think I said before, we don't see too many. We do have a couple companies in town that rent them, so you'll start to see groups. Uh-huh. And usually they're visitors. You know, you'll see like a family out, you know, maybe the older parents and kids, grandkids. So that's where we've seen them primarily. We've seen a few commuters that have them that, you know, they either are going to stay on the road, or if they need to get off, they'll get on the trails and do it. But it hasn't been an overwhelming number by any means.
So it sounds like, Adam, that you were saying that the next step then is for, if we can get at the local level some other Parks and Recs organizations to take Michelle's example or Ben Parks and Recs example, and then have it spread around. But then there's a next step in which the local jurisdictions have to, well, this is the question, connect to more the state and offer up their example, and also somehow make it happen one level up.
Yeah, and I mean, that's already happening at the state level with state parks having, e-bikes permitted on, soft surface pathways wider than 8 feet.
Okay.
And they're starting to put some of that use in here and there, and there aren't actually that many resources in the parks that that's available for, but it's some.
Okay.
And then, yeah, just moving to the federal level from there to get some, I mean, for off-road use, and trail access, the reality is they're designated as a motorized vehicle because they have a motor, whether it's electric or not. And we're just getting into the age of electric motors, and we're going to see a lot of different kind of electric motors, and some certainly aren't going to be the same as a pedal assisted mountain bike experience. They're going to be electric motorcycles or hovercrafts or jetpacks or whatever we're going to see in the future, you know.
So, yeah, well, I mean, it sounds silly right now, but
yeah,
In a decade, the landscape's going to be pretty different. And in 50 years, it's going to be very, very different, you know? And this is all just part of change and growing pains. Again, my kind of zoomed out existential view of it all.
And one of the things...
In the meantime, we need...
Go ahead. One of the things that I've seen, and that's different in Europe than here, is they have a lower limit on how fast the bikes can actually go on trail or on go in general, even, I think, on the road. Is that correct?
They do, and I'm not exactly sure what those regulations are, but I think it's 2 miles an hour slow for 2 miles an hour slower for off-road mountain bikes. It's 25 kilometers an hour. I think this is 18 miles an hour somewhere thereabouts.
And what I found in my brief experience of riding an e-mountain bike on a trail is that I couldn't go nowhere near. Unlike an e-bike when I'm riding it on the road, where I could. If it's
throttle
a straight
it.
Road, I could throttle it and I can pedal fast and I could really go. On an e-mountain bike, I couldn't go faster than my technical skills allow, basically.
For sure.
Have you found that be true?
There's not necessarily. I mean, I ride e-bikes in technical terrain about as fast as I ride a regular mountain bike, which is pretty darn fast.
Right. Well, that's you. I mean, for the average, we both know that.
But it is.
I am not Adam Craig.
Sure, but I mean that. that's the other end of the spectrum, right? And it's kind of like you're going to ride an e-bike about like you're going to ride any other type of bike. It's just going to provide you with a little bit of assistance in getting to where you're going, you know, which is great. And that certainly affects user density. And there's places that doesn't make sense. But it's not a motorcycle, so we need to just continue building from this, local and state level to the federal level to have a different designation for, a class one pedal assist e-bike doesn't need to exist either in the fully motorized trail user spectrum or in the non-motorized. It is in the middle, and it's a lot closer to the non-motorized, to be honest. So I think we can get there. It's just people need to start asking about it. I mean, the reality is in the states for off-road e-bike access, there's a lot of negativity and rhetoric and finger pointing, but there aren't really that many people. You talk to federal level land managers and there aren't that many people that are really asking for access for them. There's kind of like, we're too busy bickering to even ask is the, what I've been told by the land managers I've been in contact with about it.
And
so
the
if
other,
people really want it, they need to start asking,
And the other thing I've seen in my experience is that the people I do see who are on e-mountain bikes right now tend to be older. That they were mountain bikers maybe from the beginning, but that they're not as able to get up the hill as they were before. And they definitely, I think, tend to ride downhill actually slower. And now that's who's using it right now. As you said, in 5-10 years, as e-bikes get more affordable, because right now good full suspension e-bikes are around $10,000, which is not affordable for your average person.
I want to jump in and say that's e-mountain bikes.
Right, e-mountain, full suspension e-mountain bikes.
Because prices are dropping for e-commuter bikes, electric commuter bikes. Those prices are going down a little
bit. And they're dropping for e-mountain bikes, too. I mean, Giant has a full suspension e-mountain bike that's $4,500, which to get a decent regular mountain bike isn't going to cost you too much less than that.
Yeah.
So it's attainable from a cost standpoint. You're absolutely right. Aging riders are using them. I mean, arguably the most well-known trailhead in all of Oregon is Phil's Trailhead in Bend, and Phil McLaughlin, who is the delightful 74-year-old man that basically started mountain biking as we know it in Bend, has an e-bike. He got an e-bike 2 years ago. His son bought him one because he was like, Dad, you're still riding, but you're kind of getting old. Like, you want to be able to do big, sweet rides and be inspired. Like, let's get you an e-bike. And Phil's using an e-bike, and I don't think anyone would question Phil's dedication to the art of mountain biking and mountain bike trails and enjoying it, you know. But he's just old and he's pumped. He's doing all these big random rides he's always wanted to do, you know. He's got two batteries, he goes out all day, brings a lunch, loves it.
Okay, maybe he's the new mascot for e-mountain biking.
But I mean, even him, he's not riding Phil's trail because he knows that he's not supposed to. He's riding random cow trails in the desert and on BLM land and using social routes and whatnot, just riding dirt roads. Like, he's not in the mountain bike network because he gets and respects the current access environment there, you know.
Yeah, and there is that's kind of part of what this show is, to point out that there's already some problems with mountain bike access in general. And, you know, with e-bikes, and one thing you touched on and you're literally doing right now is stewardship and the ability. People with higher usage means trails need, there's more people on trails. There's more trails there than the Forest Service can take care of themselves. And the Forest Service is kind of changing their, we take care of our trails, to we are utilizing volunteer groups, like the one that you're out there with right now, to have their manpower and their labor come out and be able to use them to fix these trails and to open up trails that are quote unquote exist but are so overgrown or so have so much blowdown of dead trees across them that they're not really usable. And for you, it sounds like your e-mountain bike is really the thing to go in and open up those trails for everyone.
For sure, absolutely. But eventually, when there's trails that I'm allowed to ride my e-mountain bike on that I want to ride, I will ride that thing for fun, just like I ride my regular mountain bike for fun, you know, kind of whatever. It's just a matter of there being a, you know, recreation experience that the usership's inspired by and wants to do. And I don't think we're going to sell that many of them until we really start getting people places to ride them without being hassled, you know?
Yeah, well, that sounds like a bit of a chicken and an egg thing, that people who are interested need to be pushing and saying that they want more access. And then at the same time, prices go down a little bit more as people buy them more. And then, I mean, there's a lot of factors that have to come together, it sounds like.
For sure. And I think ultimately, in my opinion, if, you know, a market isn't really super demanding of a product, like e-mountain bikes in the States aren't necessarily in a lot of places now because there's such limited opportunities to use them. If, you know, there's entities that are motivated to promote their growth, they need to just really be organized and start asking for them. We just haven't seen that much organization yet. And as you know, we're building the Oregon Mountain Bike Coalition, which is going to be a coalition of the existing mountain bike clubs around Oregon to just have a unified voice at a state and ultimately federal level for mountain biking in Oregon. And, you know, we were forced to make the decision that we don't want to take e-bikes on because it isn't going to help us in our partnerships and negotiations with other conservation and preservation groups, because the conversation is ultimately fairly toxic at this point. And we would love to deal with it. I would love to have the OMBC be able to help figure the e-bike access situation out, but we just kind of can't risk our position with other more important things for our mission.
And we had another stewardship group from another state that was invited to come on the show, and they basically said, we wrote one article, posted one blog post about e-mountain bikes, and they're in an area where they have a lot of motorized trails, mostly for motorcycles. So e-bikes should have no problem on them. And they wrote a thing about working with the land managers to go. So I invite go on e-bikes and kind of have an experience on e-bikes and just test out how those felt on the trails and what their use would be and what the difference was. And they actually turned down the opportunity to be on the bike show today because they said it was so literally toxic of an environment that even them just writing that blog post caused such blowback that they could not agree to be on the show right now in the environment that we're in.
Yeah, which is, I mean, I assume you're referring to the Sierra Butte Trail Stewardship, who's doing an amazing job of creating a rural tourism economy in some pretty depressed areas of the Sierra on motorcycle trails. Like, those are motorcycle trails. I can go there and ride my 40 horsepower smoke billowing motorcycle on those trails. That's what they're designated for, and that's what they're funded to provide for, you know. So the fact that the conversation even, yeah, and I've been in touch with those guys, they're struggling to make it happen down there, and it blows my mind because those are motorcycle trails.
Those are motorcycle trails, and you're talking about adding in something that isn't going that much faster or that much slower. Like you said, it's definitely more. And mountain bikes are allowed on those motorcycle trails and ride those motorcycle trails right now. But you mm-hmm. add this electric component and all of a sudden everything just
okay, I don't
goes
know.
Sideways.
It's weird though. It seems like we haven't gotten to the heart of the issue. If it's so toxic and contentious, I don't understand yet what's going to turn that corner. Is it just going to be the mass of people that get out there and then everybody will have to deal? I don't get it. Do you get it?
Adam?
I don't get it either. I'm on the edge of my seat. I can't wait to find out. But I think it's just going to be a continued conversation and, you know, people who are open to sticking their neck out a tiny bit, at least starting conversations. And it's like I said, if people really want it, they need to start asking for it because the land managers aren't getting that much asking for it. So maybe that means that nobody wants it. And if nobody wants it, that's fine. You know, we don't need to want everything that comes along in this fine world. Like, yeah. So,
well, in my theory is that what we will see is with an aging boomer population and an aging mountain bike population, we will see people who want and need that extra assistance. People like Phil who are out there and say, hey, like, yeah, I'm having this fine experience on these, you know, gravel roads and things, but I'd really like to get back onto trails. And when there's enough of them, I think that's kind of where our draw is going to be because I think also just people experiencing, April, you can speak to this a little bit, but people going, if you've never ridden an e-bike, period, an electric assist bike, it is a joy.
It
and
is.
A pleasure, and it's really, really fun. And so to add that to mountain biking kind of adds in another, and I just think there's also a lack of experience and knowledge around it
right
now.
I
so maybe so. Having more people experience and knowledge, and maybe it in your, you know, your art, like you said, in 2013 you got e-bikes to commute on and you thought it was going to be the big wave
right away,
and it hasn't and it hasn't come, but I think it is still coming. It's just taking a little longer than we thought it would.
Yeah, although I would say that it feels a little bit like the idea of E, just putting that little E on there. And even with cars, I own the Bolt electric car, and I'm still amazed that there seems to be this undercurrent. Maybe it's this fear that if we let fossil fuels go away, something horrible will happen to us. But it seems like there's just a fear when you add E to the equation, and it seems like it's there on commuter bikes. It seems like it's there on mountain bikes.
Yeah.
It's weird.
It's very weird. Well, Michelle Healy. Oh, go ahead, go ahead, Adam.
I was just saying, I mean, regarding commuter bikes versus mountain bikes, I think it's a great solution for commuting. I mean, if we can get people getting a little bit of exercise and not in the car, that's
right.
Awesome. And we should keep doing that. And for mountain biking, it's kind of like I can be perfectly honest, take it or leave it. I mean, I think it's cool and I think it's great. And like I said, I have a dirt bike anyway, so I don't really care. But if people don't own it, then we certainly don't need it, you know, like we don't need a lot of the things we have. So we'll, yeah, let's just see
what
the,
goes.
It's a free market, right? I mean, if we let the free market forces act upon it, it will ultimately sort itself out. So
maybe.
Maybe.
In some way or another.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank Michelle Healy, Planning and Park Services Director for the Bend, Oregon Parks and Recreation District for joining us on the show and talking a little bit about their decision to allow e-bikes on their more local urban and soft surface urban trails.
Yeah,
thanks, Michelle.
Thanks for having me. You're welcome. Absolutely. Good luck.
Thank you. As well as Adam Craig, who's an Olympian, former pro cyclist, current Giant Bicycles rep, Oregon Timber Trail board member, and trail steward. Literally in this moment when he's off the air, he will be going back to doing some, are you logging? Are you doing trail? What kind of work are you doing today?
We're doing a bunch of drainage work.
Drainage work.
What needs to be done before the deluge that happens all winter here in the fine regions of Cascadia.
And drainage work is one of the most important things for trails not eroding. So thank you for being out there and doing that work, and as well as joining us on the air today from out in the forest. We super appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
Thanks, Adam.
Yeah, well, thanks for having the conversation. I think it's important, and I think we need to keep having it. So let's try and do that and be open-minded.
Thanks, Adam. You've been listening to the KBOO Bike Show, broadcast from the KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon, on the first Wednesday of every month. We have links to all our guest websites on our Facebook page, and podcasts are on iTunes, as well as all past episodes are generously archived at bikeshow.portlandtransport.com. The Bike Show is produced by myself, April Streeter, and Alon Robb. We'd like to also thank our in-studio engineer, our web host, Chris Smith, and today's guest, as well as our editor, Josh Hetrick. If you have comments, questions, or show ideas, The Bike Show would love to hear from you. You can contact us on Facebook, at our Twitter handle, at KBOO Bike Show, or email us through the KBOO website. We'll be back next month with more news and views from the bike world. Until then, make it a great day and keep riding your bike, woo! Electronic or not.
Exactly. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam. Ride up in Forest Park. You can ride with the light if you ride in the dark. You can ride from the mountain down to the beach. You can ride on a trail. You can ride in the street. You can ride through a puddle. You can ride in the rain. You can take it on a bus. You can take it on a train. Take a ride through the waterfront or down from the zoo. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam. It doesn't matter if you're big or small. You can take a ride to work. You can ride to the mall. Just keep the sky up above and the ground underneath. Get some wind in your hair and some bugs in your teeth. Everybody, ride your bicycle. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together to pedal and roam. Let's get together and leave our cars home. Everybody, get on your bicycle. Let's get together.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got four requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience, I...